Rhonda Girard, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hi. Hi, Sam. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. How are you doing today?
I'm good.
Good, good.
I just want everyone to know that you guys were being really, really naughty before. And now you're being all serious.
Now we're being, wait a minute. Were we being nasty? Were we being bad?
No.
Bad hombres?
We were being nasty.
We were telling off-color jokes.
Right. You were just being the way you are right now, which I really like.
Are you in Fresno?
I am in Fresno. I love Fresno.
I miss Fresno.
Beautiful.
You know, one of the things
here
that really struck me.
It's here. It's in the center of California.
You came to Fresno, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. I don't remember exactly. But one of the things that struck me is you were talking, when I was in Fresno the other day, and you are the kind of person that really knows how to enjoy her city, to get as much as you can out of it. And you were saying, yeah, I went to a Chicano punk rock or death metal band the other day. I forget which one.
Yeah,
I
Prayers.
Thought,
dang. Dude, they're so good. They're goth death. They're like, they call themselves Cholo Goth.
Uh-huh. Nice.
So, yeah.
It's like extra hardcore.
Yeah, but it's also really, honestly, like, they're called Prayers. Check them out. They're like, they're from Southern California, and they're not really a metal. They're more like a goth, like, hard pop, if that can even exist, like electronic.
Wow, I can already see that this band is somehow going to make its way into one of your future stories. You know, your book has so much range. Speaking of stories, your book has so much range in terms of the characters.
Okay.
Like, you know, I mean, that's one of the things that immediately struck me was the range of not just obviously the different perspectives and different stories, but just the characters themselves, completely unexpected. I guess one of my first questions.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a big compliment. One of my first questions would be, you know, where do you?
Well, it's the truth.
Yeah, it is. Where do you get your characters from, Rhonda? Like, where do they emerge? Are they from just you being, like Daniel says, you know, in the midst of all these cities that you're a part of, or where do they come from?
I think it's a mixture of that. I think it's a mixture of being a person who's a bunch of different people. Mm. But don't be concerned, I'm on medication. But like, it's basically like, yeah, it's all the lives that a person lives when they're, you know, when they're a refugee. So just growing up in so many different places. I grew up in Kuwait, and I also grew up in Egypt, and I also grew up in New York, and I also grew up in Texas, you know? So I think that, like, all of that makes it so that there's, my imagination is populated by different characters. And for this book, I wanted most of the stories to be in the first person.
Right.
So that I could be sort of, you know, channeling those characters. But for me, it's really about language and about the characters telling me who they are, like, once I start writing about them. So.
Right.
Well, that's that. I had a question I was going to ask you later, but this looks like an actual fantastic segue into it. When we sit down and write, sometimes we don't know really anything until we reach the end of the sentence. And I'm wondering if you allow syntax, if you allow rhythm to guide you into a story, and if you're often surprised about the character or where the story is going.
Yeah, I mean, I think that every time I'm writing, that's what I'm working with, is I'm working with a sentence. So I allow the sentence's structure and the musicality of it to guide me. And I think it's because, or a lot of it is because my mom was a pianist, my sister's a composer, many people in my family are musicians, and I'm not, because I just suck at it. So.
But you're musical in a different way, because definitely the language in here is beautiful. And I'm thinking about, you know, I have my favorite stories, of course, and we'll get into that later. But
yeah, that's what I want to get into.
One of the stories that seems a lot different from the other ones is Prisoner Number 287690. Yeah. Quite a long title and really interesting story, unlike anything else.
Yeah.
But it definitely has its own kind of music. And I'm wondering how this story came about and found its way into this collection, which is you know, like I said, it's different from the other stories.
Well, which is great. I should set it up too for our listeners that it's actually a personification of a falcon, you know, is behind the story. But yeah, go ahead.
I was on a residency a few years ago, probably 4 or 5 years ago, and it was in Turkey, and I was reading the news because I was trying not to write because I was procrastinating. And on the news, there was a story about this bird that had been captured by Turkish officers and x-rayed because they found these Israeli tags on its claws. And so they just this is something that happens in the Middle East. There are these birds. Obviously, there's a lot of migratory birds, and at Tel Aviv University, they tagged a lot of these birds to monitor their migration patterns. And then these poor birds end up like with these Hebrew, you know, these bracelets in Hebrew around their claws, and then they land in a place that, you know, Israel has bombed at some point or has, you know,
right.
occupied or whatever, right? And so the people there are afraid. They're afraid of the birds. They think they're either, and then they land in these places that Israel's like colonized or bombed or otherwise terrified, right? And
right.
So the people in those places end up, you know, either roasting these birds, like,
or interrogating them.
Or interrogating them, yeah.
Or, you know, just being afraid of what they contain, essentially. And so in this news story, they'd taken this bird and they'd x-rayed it to see if it had any sort of, you know, spying whatever.
Right.
Materials or technologies or whatever, and then released it. And I just thought that was amazing. I just imagined this bird, you know, like, I mean,
right.
The first thing I thought was that this is an Arab bird. Like, this is a bird, right? This is a Palestinian bird. This is a bird that doesn't really have, isn't Jewish, isn't Muslim, isn't atheist, isn't Christian, isn't Druze, isn't Armenian, isn't, you know, any of those things. It was just a bird. You know, and it's been caught in these kinds of, you know, geopolitical circumstances, and literally caught like twice, once to be branded and once again to be examined. And that to me just represents what it means to be an indigenous person with no, you know, no rights and no access to their own resources or land or, you know, any of that. So that really... I was really drawn to that. And so when I first wrote the story, it was in first person, like the other stories. And then I noticed that it was kind of, I just wanted to put a frame around it. I noticed that it was like it wasn't as vibrant, not in terms of the storytelling, but as it, like in terms of how it's framed.
Right.
And so I put the frame around it of the officer actually interrogating the bird because I've been interrogated before. So I just thought, I'm just going to use this kind of back and forth because it's the reality of this character and of what the character represents.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then at the end, probably one of the more touching parts of that story is when the Falcon realizes that he can't return home or doesn't know how to get back home and pretty much is just permanently displaced.
Exactly. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Through all of these.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that, I mean, you have a few stories actually, I think that are, you know, either personification of animals or birds, or in the case of Zelba, the Hafia, who is a half woman and half Transjordian Ibex character.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to ask, you know, what is it about the animal as the sort of as human or vice versa? What is it about that? I think that intersection that intrigues you.
I mean, I think, being an Arab American and a Palestinian in the 20th and 21st century, you're constantly being dehumanized. Like you're a problem. You're your cattle, you know, you're to be used or you're to be slaughtered or and you're definitely not someone whose story is important or counts or is, you know, widely circulated or accessible to anyone else. So I think that's what it is. I think it's feeling dehumanized and seeing how when you don't exist in a narrative, when you don't exist in a popular or main or whatever narrative, and you don't have a voice, then you're not fully human. You're not reflected. Your experience is not reflected. Your reality, your personhood. So I think that that's what attracts me, and specifically animals, because, I mean, animals have language. And just because we don't understand it, you know.
Right.
I don't know. I understand my cat and my dog, but I would never attempt a story from their point of view, because it would just be about how I suck. So don't feed them properly.
You have the story called Accidental Transience, which is one of my favorites. And definitely my favorite line in the entire book comes out of that story, when a family is sitting around the table.
Oh, yeah.
And somebody says, or the narrator says, that we are bound to God by the absence of pig grease.
Thank you. You know, my editor tried to get me to cut that.
Oh, that's crazy. That was one of the best lines. And it really shows what we're not seeing really anywhere else. I've never quite read a book like this, where we're getting a perspective of Muslims, culturally
right.
Muslim. And I think of myself
right.
as, a cultural Catholic, you know, where sometimes
absolutely.
In spite of myself, I'll do the sign of the cross when I pass a church. And you're really giving us insight into these characters
right.
and into what it's like. And I'm wondering if this is, are there other books like this, or are you just like trailblazing, giving us a perspective of Muslim Americans that we wouldn't usually get?
Mm, yeah.
I think there are, yeah. There are books like this. Other books like this would be The Hakawati by Rabia Alameddine,
right.
And his other books. And who else writes about secular Muslims? Mohajakaf. K-A-H-F writes about secular Muslims, there's a lot of poetry. So Hayan Sharara, C-H-A-R-A-R-A, tons and tons of poetry. So Naomi Shihab Nye, and so I think it's mostly, I would say that like earlier on, most Arab American and Muslim American lit has been poetry. I don't like to claim that I'm trailblazing anything because I'm a woman. I feel like if I was a man, I would just be like, yes, this is
trailblaze.
I mean, in a lot of ways, I think people have said that my first book, A Map of Home, was, you know, it was really hard to get published, and it was published by a small press and then eventually picked up by Penguin. And that was a big deal because the book is about secular Muslims and secular and Arab Americans and Palestinians specifically. I don't know if there's like a ton of representation in general of secular Muslims or Palestinians, because I think it's better, right, for our cultural, or, you know, it's better for our empire that characters like that remain invisible. So, you know, a Muslim who wears hijab or is practicing is much more easy to identify, right?
Right, yeah.
So a secular Muslim is not, and therefore, how can we target them, you know?
Right.
So I think that ends up being part of why these stories are missing.
And then the book, I mean, the book throughout is humorous. You know, there are these wonderful moments where I just laughed out loud, actually. And probably one of the stories that comes to mind is The Sailor, where the husband and wife discuss having an affair, and she has this affair with a Turkish sailor, and she wishes that her husband were upset by this, but he's not. And that's the whole premise of that is kind of humorous. But but my favorite story, actually, for me was Grace. You know, I like that story a lot. It was it's a story about it, just to kind of encapsulate. It's a story about a young girl who's kidnapped in a toy store by a family who keeps her and loves her. And in the end, her sister writes a book about this, her sort of estranged sister, or her long-lost sister writes a book about it anyway. And it's a fantastic story. It was really, really unexpected, the turn in it. And obviously, I'm sure you're well aware, this is probably an entire book on its own, this story. And I was just curious to know, what's the story behind that?
I was, thank you for enjoying it. I was really curious about writing a white character, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so this is my take on, like, whiteness. And I was also at a residency. And I'd been seeing all these, like, doll-like figures, you know, whenever I left the residency. And then I started thinking about dolls and thinking about these sort of old porcelain dolls, you know, with their, you know, whatever they represent about white, you know, female beauty and all that stuff. And then
right.
I was thinking about, you know, how that beauty is something that you can possess in a doll, right? And then this character essentially came through sentences like we were talking about earlier, where she kept talking about being kidnapped by love. And at the same time, I was reading about captivity narratives and about these white women that had been captured by tribes and people of color and had better experiences.
yeah. Right.
You know, and so I thought about what you know, we hear all these stories about people being kidnapped, but we don't, and about Stockholm syndrome, obviously, which some people in my family have, but like I hadn't really thought about what it would mean for a character to experience, like, what's it like to be that person who experiences that, and then it's free to go and doesn't go back to their family because they just don't. That's just not their.
Right.
That's not their family anymore.
Right.
I mean, that to me is also about immigration, right?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So that's where that story came from. And
that last line was just fantastic. The last line in that story was great. I love that line. Yeah, it put the nail in the coffin, so to speak. You know, it was just wonderful. It put a stamp on it. We're speaking with the award-winning author and professor Rhonda Jarrar about her fantastic new collection of stories, Him, Me, Muhammad Ali, out with Sarabande Books. And the title story for me was like, it's a touching story, and I would call it one of the more sort of straightforward stories of all the collection. You know, is it drawn from your own life? I mean, I guess that's kind of a, I guess that's my question. Is it something that's drawn from your own life? Because the stories are so, you know, like I said, such range. You're going from, you know, personification and animals and half animals, and suddenly you go to this really kind of straightforward, almost sober narrative, you know, about this photograph.
Yeah. So, the story is about a biracial woman whose parents are now dead.
Right.
And so she goes to Egypt, where her mom's from, to scatter the ashes of her father, who's black and who identifies with ancient Egyptians and Afrofuturism and all these ways that he's connected to Africa and to Egypt. And so she goes back to scatter his ashes and ends up mourning her mother.
Right.
And so I think that I wanted to do like a straightforward, realist story.
Right.
I think that I don't know. I love those kinds of stories too.
Sure.
And I think in terms of language, this character, you know, I wanted to see how a character who'd been conceived during the Ali Foreman fight.
Right. Yeah. I know. I love that sequence of the knock of the one punch, the two punch, and like, you know, all that going on is fantastic.
Yeah, because when you see documentaries or read about that fight, right, in 1974 and what was then Zaire, I think what you see or hear are very masculine narratives.
Right.
It's about, you know, like, it's about black men fighting each other in the jungle, right, the rumble in the jungle and all
right,
of this,
right.
like, identity stuff, and it's very, very masculine. You know, it's covered by all these white male journalists, but there was also music there. There was a huge music festival, and I thought about what it would mean to, or what it was like to be a journalist during that time, because there was a 6-week gap between when the fight was supposed to happen and when it happened because of an injury.
Right.
And so 6 weeks is a long time. I was like, people are getting pregnant. Like, I don't care. People are getting pregnant. You know.
And you said the injury was due to an ashy elbow.
Exactly, because of an ashy elbow. So
best.
I'm like, you know, as someone who was born in the 70s, like and as someone who is of, you know, both Palestinian and Egyptian descent, like I was just thinking about what it's like to be a person who was conceived at that fight. And So, yeah, that's where that story came from. And, yeah, my dad claims that there's a picture of me with Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
And I've never, ever seen it. And so this was my way of being like, well, what would it mean? What does that picture mean?
Right,
and,
yeah.
And I love the twist at the end of what the picture really ends up being, which I won't say because people have to read it.
Yeah, it's great.
But when the main character goes back with her father's ashes to Egypt, she visits her mother's family. And as she's waiting around, I think it's a cab driver says to her, well, you know, he speaks to her in English and she speaks back in Arabic. And he says, oh, well, you know, you look like an Egyptian, but you sound like a quagga. How do you pronounce that?
Quagga.
Mm-hmm. Which is basically like a pocho if I went back to Mexico City, right?
Exactly.
And I love how you write about that experience of people educated, culturally part of all their lives at the United States, and they go to Egypt and suddenly they find themselves in another, well, kind of a their culture, but not their culture.
Yeah, or outsiders, or they're forced to be, you know, they're not seen as insiders, or they're not seen because of the way they look, because of even the way they walk. Like, I've been told when I go back to Egypt that people can tell that I'm not from there by the way I walk, just by the way my feet touch the ground. So, and that makes sense, right?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
I mean, everywhere you go, there's a way people are walking. And like when I go to New York, you can tell that I'm not from there because of the way I walk.
So where do you go where people think you're from?
That's a great question, yeah.
Oh, that is a really good question.
It is.
Because I mean, honestly, are a pilgrim.
Fresno?
Yeah.
Fresno?
I don't know. I feel like my favorite thing about living in Fresno is when I'm at a bar and a 24-year-old guy is like, where'd you go to high school? And I'm like, you know, approaching 40, and I'm like, oh, honey, you know. I went to three different high schools in, you know, two different countries. So, like, maybe Fresno? I don't know. I mean, I know people know that I'm not from here, but still, like, I don't feel like such an outsider here. And I think that's why I like it so much, you know.
Right.
You know, there's a quote that I always liked by Borges. And I'm going to ask you, if we have time, a little bit about your Borges elements, like one of reviewer said about this book. But he says that every detail is an omen. And, of course, this has been articulated by many different kind of writers. That,
absolutely.
You know, but there's this one detail in your story about the young woman who returns, I mean, the accidental, no, I'm sorry, it's in Me, Him, Me, and Muhammad Ali. And it's describing the scene in Egypt. And it says, on top of the building across from me, dozens of satellite dishes faced in the same direction as if praying to the sun. And this image is juxtaposed with men on a rug outside, you know, facing one direction, and the satellites facing another direction. And I just love this image because, really, in many ways, it's what this book is about. People who are culturally Muslim and people who are connected to the Middle East, to Egypt, or to Palestine, but who nonetheless have this kind of happy going on, like one of your characters. They're part this and they're part that, and it's really just kind of a beautiful image. Is this something that you set out to write a book about, this kind of experience? I mean, did you know it was going to be about this, or is it just, again, just following language and it just, this is what was on your heart and your mind and your soul or whatever?
Absolutely. I think it's a combination of all of those things. I think it's the reality that I live and that a lot of my friends live. It's a subject I'm obsessed with. And so it's something I set out to do. And it's also something that I had to do, like whether I wanted to or not.
That's how
I think. And that's what I write about. And so, and I think, like, I'm glad that you like that image. And I think that for me, one thing about that image, too, is that, you know, no matter what direction these objects or people are facing, you know, the world is not linear, right? It's not this, like, straight phallic line. It goes in a circle, so they just end up back where they started, right? No matter what direction they look at, it, it, the gaze goes all the way back to them. And so for me, it's my way of doing that. It's my way of writing about these experiences from someone who's, you know, from our own gaze or my own gaze, rather than have others capturing stories about us that are inauthentic and, you know, kind of stupid.
You kind of make this reference when you say in one of the stories, you're talking about being Lebanese or being Ethiopian, and you say in parentheses, in other words, hot. And I'm thinking about that idea that...
Oh, yeah, I know that, we're hot.
Yeah, the Muslim women in literature or in popular culture are either vilified or exoticized.
Right.
And I think you really show us an experience of Muslim women that, you know, frankly, you know, it really is... it really is a perspective that that is important. That's, I don't know. I didn't even know how to say it. In fact, maybe you should edit this out because my question is leading nowhere. Let me start that again.
I think that line, it's like, I know we're hot, right? It's about, it is about how Muslim and Arab women and men are exoticized and eroticized, but it's also about how the subject of us is hot. Like, we as a subject, like we as something on the news, or, you know, it's hot. It's a hot topic, right? Like, oh, terrorism, you know, Muslims, oil, like all of these, this is a hot topic, but we don't get to, you know, our voice isn't hot. Right, topic's hot, but our voice isn't hot. Our our actual selves are not hot because, well, unless we've been droned, then we're quite literally hot from being burned. But I mean, I think that it's something that infuriates me and my, you know, I run this Radius of Arab American Writers, it's a literary organization, it's a nonprofit, and back and forth we'll be texting with me and my friends, and I'll be like, so are we in yet? Like, are our stories in yet? Like, when are we going to be in, like, in the literary world? Like, when are our stories, like, when will we be taken seriously, you know, as also as writers? And as, so I think that that's one thing that, you know.
Well, I think this book is going to do that.
It's a fantastic, fantastic collection, Rhonda. And so fresh. The stories are fresh and unexpected, and it's just a great read. The book we're talking about is Him, Me, Muhammad Ali, out with Saraband Books by award-winning author Rhonda Girard. Thank you, Rhonda, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.